Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to the program with me, Crispin Mwakideo, in Bonn. In this edition, the trial of suspects linked to the Westgate Mall attack begins in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Some of them were communicating with their attackers before and during the attack, and others were the ones who had given them a place to stay.
The conflict in South Sudan enters its second month, but a ceasefire deal remains in doubt.
What is ironical is, as the delegates are here talking about peace, down on the ground they keep giving us information that we have captured this area, Malakal is under this control and that.
And the EU Parliament strikes a deal which they hope will prevent food prices from rising. All these stories and more right up after this.
Top story.
We begin in Kenya, where the trial of four men charged in connection with last September's Westgate Mall raid opened in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The men are not accused of carrying out the attack, but of lending support to the gunmen. The four suspects have all pleaded not guilty. The attack, which Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for, killed at least 67 people. Our correspondent in Nairobi, James Shimanyula, was in court and sent us this report.
The four Somalis, Mohamed Ahmed Abdi, Liban Abdullah Omar, and then Mohamed Dek Ibrahim and Hussein Hassan Mustafa are now sitting in the dock, waiting for the trial magistrate to enter the court. There is tight security inside and outside the court. The courtroom is silent. The magistrate is just getting in now. Silence.
Leading prosecution against the Somalis is one of Kenya's state counsels, Mungai Warui. His first witness was Stephen Juma Injusi, one of the 33 guards at the Westgate shopping mall. Speaking in Kiswahili, Injusi flashed back to September 21 last year.
It was about 12:30 p.m. when a white car emerged and stopped in the middle of Mwanzi Road that enters the Westgate Mall. Three people alighted from the car and began walking towards the entrance. On reaching the mall, they shot a customer that was entering and thereafter started shooting randomly. There were screams everywhere and I used my walkie-talkie to call for help and alert other guards as I walked to the main entrance. Later, security men swarmed the area and I joined them to rescue people that had been injured, putting them in ambulances.
State prosecutor Mungai Warui is confident that he has a strong case against the Somalis. Speaking to me at lunch break, Warui said,
"The evidence is good, it's a full proof. We have substantial evidence."
Commenting briefly on the role played by the accused Somalis during the Westgate attack, Warui had this to say.
Some of them were communicating with their attackers before and during the attack, and others were the ones who had given them a place to stay.
Warui told the court that he intends to call 40 witnesses to testify against the four Somalis during the hearing that is expected to last 2 weeks.
James Shimanyula in Nairobi. One of the reasons blamed for the Westgate attack was Kenya's corrupt immigration system and its porous borders. So has anything changed since the September attack? Emmanuel Kisiangani is a senior researcher with the Institute for Security Studies in Nairobi. He told me Kenya is making efforts in securing its borders, but challenges remain.
Much has changed, although we have had attempts, actually, if the government indicated a while back that it had been dismissed a few of the immigration officials. Increasingly, we are also seeing efforts to actually to improve the security agencies. We're seeing a vetting process. So they are attempts, but they're not that dramatic to say now there are quite substantial changes and these things may not reoccur.
And what measures should the country then take to make its border and territory more secure?
It looks like what the government is doing currently is to take the war to actually the extremist group itself inside Somalia. Kenya's defense forces are in Somalia under the flag of AMISOM, but in the recent past we have been given reports that they have actually attempted to target areas or strongholds where these groups are. So to begin with, I think it's about putting the group under pressure inside Somalia so that they cannot organize. But internally also, we have seen attempts by the government to suggest that they will not actually exit particular security apparatus who allow people who don't have proper documents to just get into the country. So they are. It looks like a multifaceted approach, but certainly it has its own challenges.
And do you think it's the right approach, or should things change?
We don't know specifically what is happening with an important aspect of this process, which is intelligence, because the challenge has been previously there were accusations that there was not proper intelligence when some of these things were actually planned inside the country, although we have other arguments that actually there has been intelligence. It's about acting on that intelligence. So we don't know what the government is doing exactly on that intelligence front, but certainly to preempt. And we have seen a reduction, actually, of such attacks. So it may give the impression that actually the government is to an extent succeeding, because since this year and late last year, there was a reduction in terms of those grenade attacks. So to an extent, I'll say the government is trying, but certainly there's scope. And this group often can weigh you down. You think now you've succeeded, and that is when you go into a lull, that is when they attack you.
So would you say that the country is more secure after the attack?
I won't say so, because the Westgate attack was not the first terrorist attack in Kenya. We had the one in 1998 on the U.S. embassy. We have several others. So you cannot guarantee, so to speak, that there is not going to be an attack, although security is a serious challenge, and there are many other dimensions to security. We've witnessed in the country attacks, inter-ethnic attacks. So if we look at it broadly, I would say the country may not have so much realized much in the course of only a period of the last few months to say that right now it is very secure.
Institute for Security Studies senior researcher Emmanuel Kisiangani in Nairobi.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
Two months and counting. South Sudan's military engaged rebels in a fierce fight in the key northern oil town of Malakar on Wednesday as the conflict in the world's newest nation entered its second month. The United Nations reported tank battles in the streets. Little progress has so far been made in the ceasefire talks in neighbouring Ethiopia, as the rival factions still remain deadlocked over rebel demands for the release of political prisoners. I've been speaking to our correspondents in Addis Ababa, Koleta Wanjohi, to find out more on the talks.
At the moment, I would say that there's a lot of uncertainty that looms during these talks in Addis Ababa. For the past 2 days, both the rebel faction led by former Vice President Riek Machar and the government side that represents President Salva Kiir have been consulting individually. They have been consulting on draft agreements that has been provided by the Intergovernmental Agency for Development, IGAD. But so far, there's a lot of uncertainty because the rebel faction of Riek Machar does not really know what President Salva Kiir has said about this whole thing. So there's a lot of uncertainty, I can say.
So what you're saying is that the delegation in Addis Ababa has moved from what IGAD had arranged, and now they're having their own sort of negotiations. Is that right?
Yes, what I'm saying is that IGAD had drafted an agreement that would talk about the cessation of hostilities that also included the issue of the 11 detainees. And that's the consultation. They gave each group the draft agreement to talk about or to consult individually. And that is when IGAD will now see what kind of joint draft that these people will sign if they agree.
South Sudan's Minister of Information, Michael Makuei, said late on Tuesday the two sides may soon agree on the cessation of hostilities. But is that optimism also shared by the rebel delegation?
The optimism of reaching an agreement is shared by both sides, even the rebel delegation. We spoke to the assistant spokesperson of the rebel delegation, Mr. Mabior Garang, and he said that the rebel faction was ready to sign, but he said that they are a bit skeptical about the government because they're not sure what modalities the government will give as far as the release of the detainees is concerned. According to the spokesperson, Mr. Makuei, the government also is optimistic. As of now, Mr. Makuei says that the government of South Sudan will only talk about the detainees as a second discussion after the rebels agree to sign the cessation of hostilities agreement first. So he says they need to go on table, sign an issue on the cessation of hostilities, then that is when the government will agree to speak about the issue of the detainees.
So in other words, these talks are really not going anywhere, are they?
If we look at it really deeply, the talks are just lingering around. It's in a luxurious hotel. They are all around the lobby all the time. Three delegates from both sides are the ones consulting. But as far as the issue of the detainees is not handled, then the reality is that the talks are not going anywhere.
Many observers say that the talks will not really actually make a difference, but rather what happens in the battlefield will decide the power balance in South Sudan. Is that the same kind of impression you get amongst the delegates?
What is ironical is as the delegates are here talking about peace down on the ground, they keep giving us information that we have captured this area, Malakal is under this control and that. And that gives you the impression that they are here in Addis Ababa doing paperwork, but down on the ground, their military forces are busy trying to acquire as much as they can of the world's youngest country. Things are not tallying, because if they are talking peace here and military action is down on the ground, then that means things are really not tallying.
Koleta Wanjohi in Addis Ababa.
Behind the headlines.
Life in Zambia isn't easy. More than 60% of the population lives below the poverty line, according to the United Nations. As in other African countries, Zambian women play an important role in the fight against poverty by starting small businesses and subsistence farming. However, despite their efforts, few banks seem ready to trust Zambian women by giving them loans. Kathy Sikombe has more on the story.
Langiwe Banda is a businesswoman who runs four grocery shops in Lusaka. The 40-year-old mother of five started the first shop 10 years ago after her mother gave her the capital of 100 euros. With no business plan, the beginning was not smooth.
It's not easy because, especially with the business that I'm doing, the profit is very minimal. And just from that same money, I have to take the children to school, pay the household bills. So it's not easy.
Langiwe is just one among thousands of women in Zambia who are facing strong challenges in expanding their businesses due to hurdles they encounter in accessing bank loans. This is because interest rates are very high at 19%, and the majority of the women don't have tangible property which can act as bank security. But this problem could soon be over, as Zambia's central bank, in collaboration with the International Labour Organization ILO, is determined to help women entrepreneurs with loans at low interest rates. So far, 10,000 women, including Langiwe, have received entrepreneurship training equipping them with accounting and business skills. However, Mwape Lubilo, a 30-year-old single mother of two, another businesswoman, has risen from just running a backyard vegetable garden to running a 10-hectare farm on a commercial basis. She also benefited from the training aimed at equipping businesswomen with financial management and business skills and will be able to get a loan.
Just changing your mindset and aiming big and gathering courage in whatever you are doing as a woman and grow big.
Tukia Kankasa Mabula is the deputy governor of the Bank of Zambia.
Financial inclusion of women is an imperative to accelerate growth and development. According to the G20 Global Partnership for Financial Inclusion, African women face a US$20 billion funding gap that is not being met. We recognize that there's need to take deliberate action to increase women's access to finance and financial services.
Access to finance for women entrepreneurs is aimed at making the process of acquiring bank loans easy for women without any restrictions. This enables women, most of whom are poor financially and without any tangible security to back their loans, in cases where they fail to pay back the loans. Maureen Sumbwe, a banker in Lusaka, explains why women have not been able to get loans easily in Zambia. She attributes the problem to most Zambians not being business people by nature, saying they prefer to be employed in white-collar jobs than go into business. As a result, most people go into business as a last resort without proper planning and skills.
types of businesses that most of the women do are micro businesses, which the banks will not look at to begin with. Secondly, most of them are startups, and most banks are not looking at financing startup businesses. Most women are forced to get their financing from microfinance institutes, which meant that they were actually working for the microfinance institutions. They were not making anything out of it.
Kathy Sikombe in Lusaka. And still on the money subject, European Union lawmakers have struck a deal which they hope will help control food prices. The regulations will limit attempts by speculators to control the market prices in raw materials like corn or wheat. The new rules, which still need the approval of EU member states, are meant to prevent a repeat of the 2008 global financial crisis. But how is this deal going to end food speculation? I put that question to Sven Gilgold, a German lawmaker at the European Parliament.
It will contain speculation to the necessary limit. It's normal and has been done since ages that if a farmer wants to sell a harvest in advance, you need on the other hand somebody who's ready to buy it to a certain price. That has a speculative element. We don't want to end that. Also, industry needs certain possibilities to secure prices in the future. But what we see at the moment on financial markets is you have lots of liquid capital driving up prices, at least for some time, causing, for instance, in the area of food, hunger. And now the new regulation coming from the EU after citizens' pressure will limit the amount of money you can invest in certain products, in raw material and food, and therefore set an absolute limit to speculation.
It would obviously take time until the regulations are coming into effect. So when are food prices, for example, in Africa, going to come down?
The main reason why food prices are high in Africa is not financial capital. The main reason is that there's not enough agricultural activity in Africa, not enough investment in the area. We have wrong subsidies in the agricultural market, destroying local farmers in Africa, and more people who are richer in the world are taking space of farming for their needs rather than the needs of the poor. So it's not speculation which is causing problems in Africa, it's making it worse. And these changes will come into force fully after implementation in the member states. So you can say after a bit more than a year, these rules should be in place.
What kind of provisions in this agreement are you unsatisfied with?
I'm basically very satisfied with the regulation we have. So we achieved really more than what we had in the original mandate of the member states, of the European Parliament and the Commission. And after the three sat together for some months, we arrived at a regulation which has no loopholes, which is really a tough rule and will set the standard also for other markets to follow.
EU member states still have to confirm the deal. How afraid or concerned are you that it might be watered down?
Also, the plenary of the European Parliament has to verify the deal. And if the member states will try to open it up, they have also achieved a lot in the negotiations. We wanted, for instance, to regulate stock exchanges in a tougher way. So they are risking of losing their issues. And you can be sure that the members of the European Parliament will not accept any weakening in this regard.
EU Member of Parliament Sven Gilgold.
Opinion.
The rights group Amnesty International on Wednesday demanded the release of more than 10 people arrested in Nigeria under the new homosexual law. EU's foreign policy chief Catherine Ashton has also condemned Nigeria's ban on same-sex unions. President Goodluck Jonathan on Monday signed the law, which has a 14-year prison term for those who enter into same-sex unions. Thomas Mosh, head of DW's Hausa Service, believes the new law is a huge blow to the respect of human rights in Nigeria. This is his opinion.
By his standards, President Goodluck Jonathan moved very swiftly. The two houses of the Nigerian parliament only agreed on a joint version of the same-sex marriage prohibition bill 2013 in December. Just weeks later, Jonathan had signed it into law amid international protests. Many Nigerians wish that their president would act so decisively in other areas of policy. After almost 3 years in office, he has accomplished very little. Instead of governing the country, he is waging battles on several fronts against opponents who want to stop him from running for the presidency in 2015. Yet, as far as the signing of this bill is concerned, he can be sure of the support of almost all of the Nigerian people. Nonetheless, this is a fateful day for human rights in Nigeria, even if most Nigerians do not agree. Firstly, despite its name, the purpose of this bill is not to ban marriage between people of the same sex. Nobody is calling for marriage equality in Nigeria. The law defines same-sex marriage not in the sense of an exchange of vows, but as any and every form of sexual partnership between two men and two women. This is a deep intrusion into the private lives of individuals. The activities of consenting adults in their own homes are no business of the government or the state. Even if the bill has the support of a huge majority, that is no justification for depriving a minority of the right to a private life of their own choosing. Secondly, the new bill penalizes anybody who supports gay partnerships or organizations campaigning for gay rights. This spells danger for friends, relatives, or parents who are not prepared to throw their son or daughter out of the house simply because they are gay. The bill is also a threat to everybody who wants to help others to protect themselves against HIV/AIDS, because it simply won't be possible anymore to talk about certain sexual practices. One is left wondering why this bill has been enacted in the first place. Homosexuality is already punishable by heavy prison sentences under Nigerian law. In the Muslim north of the country, Sharia courts can even hand down the death penalty. It would appear that Nigeria's political elite is trying to recapture the moral authority it has long since lost at the expense of a minority that is already being persecuted. With this goal in mind, Nigeria's politicians have been spreading lies and disinformation about gay marriage. One example is, "This is something the West wants to force upon us." But no Western government has ever demanded that another country should legalize same-sex marriage. Their concern is simply to ensure that people are not thrown into prison or even killed merely because their way of displaying love and affection is not accepted by a majority. Another example is, all the world's major religions vehemently reject homosexual relationships. In Nigeria, and in most other African countries, this may be true. But seen from a global perspective, that assertion is just wrong. In South Africa, the Anglican Church already treats gay worshippers equally. Europe's Protestant churches do likewise. Even the Pope has urged Catholics to treat gay men and women with compassion and not expose them to hatred and persecution. There are countries in Africa in which homosexuality has not been banned, and they include some of Nigeria's neighbors. South Africa is regarded as a pioneer in the struggle for gay rights. None of these countries is better or worse off than others. Nigeria's politicians should start focusing on the country's real problems. When is Parliament going to take tough action against the inequality in the country that permits only a tiny elite to benefit from the country's wealth? A country in which the streets are full of beggars and in which the vast majority can afford neither education nor health care. Most Nigerians regard the time that has elapsed since the last election in 2011 as years of missed opportunities, because none of the country's major problems have been tackled. A law outlawing homosexuality, which has already been banned anyway, won't change that.
Head of DW's Hausa Service, Thomas Mursch, wrapping up this edition of Africa Link. But just before we go, here's a reminder of our main stories. The trial of four suspects accused of having links with Kenya's Westgate attackers opened in Nairobi. South Sudan's crisis has entered its second month, but ceasefire talks remain deadlocked. And there we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. For comments and suggestions, simply send a text message to +491609575910, an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. Thanks for your company. From me, Crispin Mwakideu, take care.